introduce Steve Hopkin from the University of Reading, the Department of Technology. He's senior lecturer in ecotoxicology, although he says that he's trying to get that converted into senior lecturer in taxonomy. But they're resisting, presumably, at the moment. Before that, that's since 1984. Before that, he worked at the University of Bristol for 4 years, looking at heavy metals in soil organisms. And he's been a long-term visitor to the department for 4 to 5 years. And it's the expectation that rather shortly he's going to become a scientific associate of the department. And so without further ado, I'd like to hand you over, Steve, for the talk, Biology of Springtails, the Most Abundant Insects, a Personal View.
Thank you. Well, after that baptism of fire, I hope the talk will live up to the preparation. There are two things I want to talk to you about today. First of all, I want to give you a general introduction to Calendula. Now, I know there are some people in the audience, at least one person who probably knows more about Calendula than I do, but for most of you, you're probably unfamiliar with the group. And I want to give you a general background to the evolution and biology of the animals. And the second thing I want to do is to describe a project that I'm involved in at the moment, which includes examining the Calendula collection in the museum and attempting to map the distribution of all the British Calendula species. Some of you who, I did a talk at the Royal Entomological Society last year, and some of you, if you went to that talk, you may get a feeling of deja vu with some of the slides, but I've tried to update the talk to include some of the more recent information. Before I start, I'd like to acknowledge a few people. Paul Eggleton and Paul Brown and Andrew Ross have been very helpful in giving me access to the collections. I'd also like to thank Peter Lawrence, who's been a constant source of stimulation over the last few years. And one of the things that Peter was in fact criticised for when he was in the museum, working full time in the museum, was the fact that he spent a lot of his time writing letters, and this has become an extremely fascinating source of information for me. Don't worry, Peter, I'm not going to embarrass you too much, but I'd just like to pick up this gem here amongst many. I'd like to dedicate this lecture to Peter Bellinger, who unfortunately died at the end of last year, who was one of the most important Calendula taxonomists. But this is a letter that Peter Lawrence wrote to Peter Bellinger, in fact, on the 12th of August 1976. And in amongst the letter, there's this statement by Peter, which still holds true, which says, "Many Calendula seem to have evolved without giving due consideration to how they might fit into a binomial system of nomenclature," which is probably not just true for Calendula, but in fact is true for many other groups of organisms as well. So how many species of Calendula are there? Well, in total in the world, there are something like 6,500 species which have been described. In the UK, there are something like 400 species on the checklist. In Europe, there's about 2,000. And it seems extremely unlikely that we've described even 10% of the species of Calendula. And I don't know if any of you have seen this paper recently. This is a sort of latest estimate of how many species of insects there are, published in the Biological Journal of the Linnaean Society by Odegaard, I think that's how you pronounce it. It's like trying to pronounce the name of the England football manager. You're never really sure if you've got it correct. But this estimate is between 5 and 10 million species of insects. And as all of you are obviously aware, we've probably only described 10 to 20% of the species. And it would seem likely that Calendula have at least that level of under description, if I can put it like that. So there are probably at least 50,000, and my guesstimate would be that there would be at least 100,000 species of Calendula in the world. There's really no argument in the literature as to whether or not Calendula are a monophyletic group. Whether they're analysed by morphological or molecular methods, agrees that they're a monophyletic group. Their autapomorphy is that on the ventral side of the first abdominal segment, they have what's called a ventral tube, which is basically a thin-walled structure, cuticular structure, which is has evolved for fluid exchange. And all species have that feature. And this, in fact, was why they're called Calendula, because Lubbock, at the end of the 19th century, gave them the name Calendula, which is derived from the Greek words, kole, which means glue, and embolon, which means piston. So this structure he regarded as a glue piston, because some Calendula also use this structure for adhering to smooth surfaces. Now, the feature which gives them their common name of springtails is on the ventral side of the fourth abdominal segment. during evolution, a pair of appendages have fused basally and formed what's called a furca, or a springing organ. And this is able to propel some species of Calendula many times their own length in a fraction of a second. In fact, the fastest jumping species, I think, is able to respond to stimuli in about 18 milliseconds. Extremely, extremely rapid. But there are, in fact, many species of Calendula which have lost the furca. It's become a vestigial or structure, or in many species it's completely absent, particularly from species which live in soil. So all springtails don't necessarily have a springing organ, if you see what I mean. Now, as I said, my interest, main interest is in mapping the distribution of species. And what we'd eventually like to do is to start a recording scheme to record the distribution of all the species of Calendula in the UK, and maybe extend that eventually to the European Invertebrate Survey. And to do this, one can involve, as again many of you will be aware, one can involve the efforts of amateur zoologists. It's so difficult nowadays to get funding for basic survey work and basic taxonomy, but there is an army of people out there, many of whom are known, I think, as the grey panthers, as opposed to the black panthers, who are people who are retired and really want something to do in their retirement time. And there are many natural historians who constantly contact me and say, how can we help helping this recording scheme? Now, what we've begun to do is to, first of all, is I produced a key to springtails. I've only had one key left, so I'm sorry, it's got writing all over it. But this was published in September last year, and this is part of the Field Studies Council Aid Gap project. And something like 250 copies of this key have been distributed, and the Field Studies Council have told me that these actually cost £12 each to produce, which is probably going to be more than the cost of the final key. But it's put out into the marketplace, if you like, for about a year. And a wide range of people use the key, and then I get back something like 200 referees reports, which is a bit daunting, and then revise the key, so the final version has hopefully removed all of the errors and difficult couplets in the key. And the idea is to publish this in autumn 2002, and then to start a recording scheme to attempt to record the distribution of Calendula in the UK. And I'll come back to that at the end of the talk with some examples of maps. Okay, the Calendula are divided, you can divide them into three main groups. And this, in fact, is a photocopy of the first part of the key. And again, I'm sorry it's got writing on it, because it's the only copy I have, but it's here it says, actually, some notes here. This is probably slightly funny. It says, this key only suitable for adults, which, of course, refers to the Calendula, but not the animals. Now, the three main groups of Calendula are divided into basically long. First of all, long ones that are longer than they are wide, and more globular-shaped ones. And this is the order Arthropleona, and these two orders, Nilopleona or Symphypleona. And the Arthropleona is subdivided into the superfamily Poduroidea, which is more commonly known as a Podura morpha, and the Entomobryomorpha of Bryomorpha. And so these are sort of globular species, but tend to be more surface active on vegetation, although this isn't a completely exclusive. The Poduromorpha are ones which live mainly in soil, and they have a well-developed first thoracic segment. And the Entomobryomorpha are ones which tend to be more surface active rather than living in the soil, and these have a reduced first thoracic segment, or in some people think that the first thoracic segment is in fact fused with the second. It's not really clear, but this is a way in which you separate these two main groups. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to go through these each in turn and show you some slides, some pictures of some of these live animals, and also go into the background of the biology of the Calendula themselves. Oh yeah, that's much better, thanks. Right, here we go. Right. Now, on the May the 26th, 1996, this in Austria, some firemen were called to what they were told was a chemical spill. And when they arrived, they discovered, when they looked closely, that this, in fact, was a collection of... I'm trying to get my hands around this technology here. Could somebody focus that, please? The focus thing isn't working on here. Thank you. Thank you very much. That's better. Right. And in fact, this so-called chemical spill turned out to be a swarm, in inverted commas, of several million specimens of a species of springtail called, in the genus Caratophycella. And this, in fact, is the way in which many people first come across Calembula. It's to these large swarms, which don't just occur on roads, as we saw in the slide, but also on glaciers and snow. And indeed, in the UK, you often find them on the surfaces of puddles. Calembula are found all over the world. This is a species called Cryptopygus antarcticus, which occurs on a stamp. Sorry, we've lost the bottom of the screen here. Is it possible to zoom that in a bit so we get the whole of the frame, please, projectionist? And this is from Falkland Island Dependency. This is probably the only Calembula on a stamp that I'm aware of. But this is a species which is widespread in the Antarctic. And in fact, Calembula occur on the surface of water, on beaches, and right up to the highest peaks of the Himalayas. So they're extremely widespread animals. On the poster, I put slightly provocatively on the title for the talk that they're the most abundant insects. I think that's true because typically in the soil, if we went outside the museum and just took a square metre of soil from the grass out there, there would be probably 30 to 40,000 Calembula per square metre. And figures as high as 200,000 per square metre have been found. So I think there's no question that they are the most abundant insects. And in most habitats, you tend to get between 20 and 40 species following a typical abundance curve. And this is an example of one from a Japanese red pine forest. And you can see that the most of the species, most of the individuals are comprised of two or three hyperabundant species. And then you get a long tail down to the rarest species down the down the right-hand side of the graph here. And in this particular habitat, we have about 40 species, and that's not untypical. Calembula show a wide range of morphology, as I mentioned it, on the overhead earlier on. This is an example of some species from caves. And they tend to, for example, they lose the jumping organ, lose their eyes and the pigment, so they tend to be white in colour. And appendages like the antennae and the legs grow longer than you maybe get in species that live outside caves. So they're also very common animals in caves. And there are some species which, in fact, are only found in caves. In the UK, the largest species is Thomisaurus longicornis, which I'll come back to later. That's this one here. And the smallest is a species called Nelus, in the genus Nelus, and that's this one here. So we have here a slide of the largest species and the smallest on the same slide to give you some idea of the size. And this one here is about a quarter of a millimetre long, about a third to a quarter of a millimetre in length. So just to give you some idea of the size range. So the biggest species in the UK is about 6 millimetres long, although the biggest species in the world is about 12 to 13 millimetres long from the Philippines. Now, that species which I showed you earlier on is in the same family, the same group, the Nelopleona, as this species. And it's just to show you that it's still possible to make new discoveries. This is a species called in the genus Megalothorax, and this was discovered as a new species from the catacombs of St. Stephen's Cathedral in Vienna in 1996 by Christian. And he gave it the specific name of Sancti Stephani, which I think is rather nice. So it is, in fact, still possible to discover new species, even in what one might think were relatively well-worked areas. Now, the furca itself, the springing organ, is folded normally under the body. This is a Thomisaurus longicornis lying on its back, and the furca here is folded under the body. And there's a slightly better view of one here. This is, unfortunately, this is a dead specimen where the furca has folded out from under the body, and you can see that it's made up of a fused area here called the manubrium, and then a pair of structures called dents, and then on the end of the dents are, on each of these, is a little sort of hook-like structure called a mucro, and the mucro is what pushes against the ground, sort of hooks against the ground, and gives them the leverage to enable them to jump. On this one also, you can see this is the ventral tube here, which is in between the appears to be in between these two legs, but in fact it's on the ventral side of the first abdominal segment. Now, the you can deduce that these structures are derived from primitive appendages, because it is possible that the segments, for the segments on which there are no appendages, to have mutant appendages. This is an example from a paper by Fjellberg. On the ventral side of this species, normally on the third abdominal segment, you can get a catch-like structure called a tenaculum, which is sort of the furca engages on this. So when the furca fires, it's sort of held by the tenaculum, and then the tenaculum releases the furca and allows it to spring. And on this particular specimen, there's an additional tenaculum on abdomen 2, which one normally wouldn't find. So clearly, there is the capacity for the segments to generate appendages, and normally this would be suppressed on abdomen 2, but for some reason in this species, it has appeared. Now, the oldest fossil columbellin, in fact, the oldest fossil insect, is a species called Rhyniella precursor from the Rhynie chert. And as in fact, Andrew Ross, let me look at these specimens. And this is from a paper by Greenslade, who's one of the authors. And this is the specimen here in Rhynie chert, and a diagrammatic interpretation of it. And if you look at the specimens themselves, it's pretty convincing that they have mandibles are inside the head. In other words, they're what's called entognathus. And this is a feature of Columbella. And this seems to be the earliest specimen of Columbella that has been found. Whoops. Okay, that's okay. You also get very well-preserved specimens in amber. This is one of the Symphy pleonid Columbella, the globular ones, preserved in Baltic amber of about 40 million years in age. And if you look at these specimens, you can assign most of them of that age to extant genera. Here's another specimen here of an entomobride Columbellan. And so it seems that there hasn't been a huge amount of evolution, certainly in terms of specimens that were found in amber and those that occur nowadays. However, if you go back and look at amber from the Cretaceous period, and there are some quite good specimens of amber from about 100 million years ago, which Ken Christiansen has been looking at in America. In that amber, there are really some very, very unusual looking animals which appear to be Columbella, but they have many features that you don't see in present day species. And Ken has suggested that along with the dinosaurs going extinct, there were lots of very interesting evolutionary lines of Columbella that were living as in epiphytic plants up in the trees, which died out at the end of the Cretaceous, at the extinction event. Not many people have looked at this amber in detail, and I think there's a wealth of information waiting to be discovered for anybody who manages to look at this material. Now, you can't do a talk without putting up a cladogram, of course. And this is probably the view that's accepted by most people. Columbella form a sister group to the Protura in a group known as a Parainsecta, which is a sister group of all the other insects. So what the take-home message of this is that Columbella almost certainly branched off very early on during the evolution of the insects. So they are an extremely ancient group. Now, Linnaeus described 10 species. This is pages 608 and eventually 609 from Systema Natura of 1758. Podura, he put all of the Columbella in the genus Podura. And the only one that survived, if you like, in the genus Podura is Podura aquatica, which we know now as Podura aquatica. All the others, of course, are now in different genera. So in 1758, there were 10 Columbella known. Interestingly enough, if you count up the total number of species in Systema Natura of 1758, it's about 6,500, which is the same as the number of species of Columbella, which are now known in the world, which is an interesting thought. And this is Podura aquatica, which is rather a cute little animal when you see it enlarged. And this species is found on the surface of water throughout northern Europe. And in fact, it's the earliest species, the earliest colour illustration of a Columbella that I managed to find, is this from a book by Lademüller in 1764. And although there's a rather lot of artistic license here, because the head looks rather like a dipteran fly, but it's unquestionably Podura aquatica, if you look at the rather artistic pictures here. But here the furca is very clearly illustrated. And if we look at Podura aquatica from the ventral side, this is a little one lying on its back, if you so to speak. And you can see here the furca is very, very clear on the ventral side of the animal. Okay, so the three main groups of Calembula, I'm going to go through them one at a time. The first of these is the Podura morpha, and this is again a slide of the swarm of the Caratophy cella. But this is an example of an individual animal, and these are quite interesting because when they form the swarms, they tend to leap around and migrate in one direction. And on this particular specimen, you can just about see the in between the fourth and the third antennal sections, there's a little expandable sac which is just expanding just before it jumps. And they use this as a sticky structure so that when they're migrating around, they don't tumble along the ground. This thing sticks along the ground when they land. And they also have inflatable sacs which come out of the anus. And this also enables them to migrate vertically up trees by jumping without falling off. Another group of the Podura morpha is the onychiurids. This is a species called Calophorura burmeisteri. These are all blind species with very absent or very reduced jumping organs. And one of the features of this group is that they have defensive pores on the surface of the body which secrete a nasty tasting chemical. And this is very repellent to potential predators like ants. This is one on its back here, and you can see this is the ventral tube just here, and an almost complete absence of a jumping organ. It's very, very reduced. I always think with this picture you could almost sort of lean in and tickle its tummy because it's quite an attractive little animal. Okay, now this is the mounted specimen of the head of one of these onychiurids. This, in fact, is in a genus called Protaferura. This is one of Brian Pitkin's slides, actually. I should acknowledge him. Yeah. And if you increase the magnification, sorry, I'll go back one. If you look in this region here, many species of Calembula have a structure behind the antennae called the post-antennal organ, which people aren't really sure what the function is, although it's probably humidity or chemical, some sort of chemosensory detector. And this structure here is comprised of a number of vesicles, and these are very important in taxonomy for separating genera and in some cases species. Now the evolution of this structure is not particularly clear. I know Peter Lawrence has put forward the theory that it's a reduced second antenna, which is as good a suggestion as any other I've read, but you also get structures like this in centipedes and millipedes, where they're known as Thomas Vari organs, although I'm not sure whether they're homologous or it's an example of convergent evolution. And if we move down the body of this Protaferura species, there are two things to look at. One is this is the vestigial furca or jumping organ, which is reduced to a tiny flap, but also you can see here the pores, which are where the defensive fluid is released as a method of repelling attack. Now, one of the problems in Calembula taxonomy, as in many areas of entomology, is the proliferation of species based on very subtle characters. And one of the major areas of taxonomic confusion in Calembula is that some people have used what's called the pseudocelli formula. And these pores from which the defensive fluid is exuded are known as pseudocelli. And they've used the numbers of these on different body segments to produce what's called a pseudocelli formula. And again, as Peter Lawrence has pointed out, there are in fact possible 120,000 possible combinations of pseudocelli formula within a single within the onychiuridae. When anybody finds a new pseudocelli formula, certainly in the past, they erected a new species for it. The problem with this, of course, is that you get asymmetry on different sides of the same specimen. So it's a very, very confusing situation. And most of the modern taxonomists tend to look at the distribution of ceti on the body rather than pseudocelli as a way of separating species at the more subtle level. The Podura morpha Calembula can be split into the two main groups, one of which has mandibles which are obviously designed for grinding the food, and another group which have reduced mouth parts which probably feed on a liquid diet. And these are the what are called the neoneurids. This is a species, a very common species in the UK called Neoneura muscorum. And I'm going to show some maps of some of these, distribution of some of these at the end. But these neoneurids have extremely large salivary glands, making as much as 15% of the body weight salivary glands. And they also have giant chromosomes. And it's a sort of accident of history that much of the early genetic work was done on Drosophila giant chromosomes. It's a shame that the person who started the research didn't pick a Calembulum, because then this would be an animal which would probably be as familiar as a Drosophila, which of course it isn't, because it's people haven't concentrated on working on this particular group. Okay, this is another neoneurid. Again, this is fairly common in the south of England. This is a species called Monobella grassii. I'm going to show you a map of this one as well at the end. And another species, which is less common, is a species called Lathriopyge longicita. And this is an example of the sort of thing you get from a general leaf litter extraction sample. This is from a garden centre in Dorset, a place called Abbotsbury. And when I was sorting through this sample, I all of a sudden came across this rather interesting looking animal. And this turned out to be this species of neoneurid called Lathriopyge longicita. It was only something like the third or fourth record for the UK. And alive, it looks like this, a much more attractive purple animal with a really very long setae on the body, which is very easy to identify. It's one of the few species that you can identify unequivocally in the UK using a hand lens. Right, now one of the things, when you go on holiday, you want to try and relax a bit and forget that what you do during your normal work. And my wife and I went on a walking holiday in North Devon in September last year, and we went for a walk along this path called the Tarka Trail, which is the old railway line from Biddeford to, I can't remember the name of the place further south, but anyway, they've converted the old railway line into a footpath. And if you walk along this footpath here, well, the first thing you come across is this information board. And if you get a bit closer, lo and behold, what's on this information board but a picture of a Calembula. And probably the first time, the only place in the UK probably where a springtail is illustrated on one of these places. Unfortunately, the caption says, this springtail takes its name from the springing organ at the back of its body. And Aneurida maritima is one of the species that has a completely reduced jumping organ, so it doesn't actually have a spring on it, even though they call it a springtail. Okay. Now, I didn't take this photograph, but this is a photograph from a paper by Casagno and De Harvey, and this just illustrates the fact that all Calembula aren't relatively unicoloured species. This is an amazing species called Paralobella arusetii, which is from the Philippines. And this has, as you can see, the first two thoracic segments are yellow, thorax three, and the first three abdominal segments are red, and then the final segments are white. And I've had a look in the atlas, and I unfortunately can't find a flag which has the same arrangement of colours on there, although I'm sure the people who described it would have liked it to be a red, white and blue stripes for the French flag. Right, now the second major group are the Entomobria morpha, and these are the species which have a reduced first thoracic segment. This is a species called Isotomirus palustris, which is very common in the UK. And if we look at this species here, these are the eyes, obviously. And this is the second thoracic segment. So the first thoracic segment is reduced, almost completely reduced. So this is thorax 2, thorax 3, and then we've got abdominal segments 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 at the end there. So that's the major characteristic of this group, is this reduced first thoracic segment. Now, some species will fuse segments. This is a species called Falsomia candida, which is used very widely in ecotoxicological experiments because it's very easy to breed in the laboratory. And this species has fused abdominal segments 4, 5, and 6. And this is a characteristic feature of this genus Falsomia. And this is a culture with lots of baby Falsomia running around amongst the others. Some Calembula are covered in scales, rather like butterflies, and they also produce iridescent colours. In fact, if you remove the scales from these, they are very finely striated, and these were used by Victorian microscopists as a resolution test for their compound microscopes. If they could resolve the striations on a springtail's scale, then it meant that their microscope was set up properly. This is a species called Lepidocertus cyaneus, and you can see this sort of iridescence which is produced by a coating of scales on the body. And from the side, again, you can see this is some specimens on a leaf. These are some mites roaming around on the leaf as well down here. This is about 2 millimetres in length, I suppose. And again, you can see this sort of iridescent colour. And this is another species of Lepidocertus paradoxus. And this shows it even more obviously, the iridescence of the scales there. If this will focus a bit more. No, okay. This is Entomobria, a species in the genus Entomobria, which is again a very common species which occurs often in trees. You can beat large numbers of them out of trees. And the remaining Entomobrides, one can split them into two main groups depending on the number of segments in the antennae. And this species, Entomobria, this is Entomobria nivalis. Most Entomobrides have 4 segments in the antennae, so we've got 1, 2, 3, 4 segments in the antennae, clearly shown on that photograph. Back. The other major group are the what are called the Orcocelids, and this is Orcocella cincta, which is again a very common species in the UK. This is a painting taken from the Ray Society volume produced by Lubbock in 1873. And all the paintings were done by somebody called Mr. Hollick, who Lubbock records in the acknowledgements was a deaf and dumb artist. But the quality of his paintings are as good as anything that's ever been produced in this group, I think. Here you can clearly see that there are one, two, three, four, five, six segments on the antennae. And I'll show you a picture to prove that in a second. And this is a live specimen of Orcocella cincta. Unfortunately, they often have asymmetric antennae, and it's not clear whether this is due to a developmental problem or due to the fact that one of them has been attacked by a predator and then has regrown. But if we find a good specimen, this is the dark variety of Orcocella cincta called Orcocella cincta vega. And this has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 segments to the antennae. This is also showing the very characteristic white coloration of the antennae there. This is one of the nicest pictures in Lubbock's book. This is Tomoceras longicornis, which has extremely long antennae, which will in fact roll into a spiral if you irritate it. And you can just about see on this specimen here, we've got scales. You can just see the scales on the animal, so these are also covered in scales. And this is a live specimen of Tomoceras longicornis. And if you hold it, I had to engage my wife in taking this photograph because I held the rock with the springtail on in front of the camera, and she then blew on the antennae and did this, which is rather nice. So it's rolled up its antennae into this characteristic curled structure. This, in fact, is a very good field character for identifying the separating this species from other species of Tomoceras. Okay, now the third main group is the Symphyae pleonids, or the more globular springtails. And this is the first illustration I've come across of a good as illustration of a Calembula. This is from De Geer in 1746, and this is a species called Elachma fusca. And this I took this photograph from the Linnaeus's own personal copy of De Geer's book, which is in the strong room in the Linnaean Society, which is the nearest I've ever got to a religious experience, I think, actually going into this to Linnaeus's collection. But this is a very, very good diagram because it contains very many accurate descriptions of various anatomical features of Calembula. And it's not a brilliant photograph, but this is the same species, Elacma fusca, walking over a house brick in my garden. Calembula are not hugely economically important in the same way as obviously certain species of Lepidoptera or aphids, for example, but there is at least one species which can cause economic damage. This is again an illustration from Lubbock's book. This is Smintheurus viridis, which is sometimes known as the Lucerne flea. It's very common in Europe, but it's been introduced to Australia and various other countries, and in Australia it can become quite a serious economic pest. And there are certain parts of Tasmania where 10% of the crops, 10% of the crops are sprayed deliberately to control the activities of the Lucerne flea, which grazes mainly crops like clover, leguminous crops like clover. This is Dicerta minor minuta, ornata, which again is a common species, very attractive coloration. Most of these Calembula do look quite nice when you look at them close up. It's the problem is they're just so small. And this is another photo, and I put this one up just to illustrate the eyes. I don't know if that can be focused. Projectionist, could you focus that possibly? That's much better, thanks. Here you can see, just about see, there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 ocelli. And this is the maximum number of ocelli that you get on each, in the eye of a Calembula on each side of the head. Many species have a reduced number of ocelli, some have none at all, but the maximum number is 8. And most of these globular springtails have 8 ocelli in each of their eyes. Now, the ventral tube is, in addition to being used for fluid exchange, can also be used for grooming. And if you watch one of these little springtails for long enough, this one's about 2 millimetres in length, you'll see them stop. They extrude the vesicles of the ventral tube, and in some cases, it can go right over the head, right over to the back of the body, extending for almost the length of the animal. And they will then move their front legs across the ventral tube and then start grooming themselves, rather like a rabbit or a gerbil does this sort of behaviour, which is quite remarkable to watch. And this is one here which is in the process of grooming itself. The ventral tube is sticking out the bottom here. It's just in the process of grooming itself, presumably cleaning its head in some way. And here's a head-on view of the same thing. This is the head with the antennae sticking out here. These are the two mucro from the springing organ or the furca, and this is a ventral tube sticking out under the head, which the animal is running its legs along to for the purposes of grooming its head. Okay, now finally, before I show you some maps on the overhead, what amazes me about some of these Calembula is they're incredibly small. In fact, the males of some of these Symphypleonid species, some of the globular species, have probably the smallest insects. Some of them are as little as 0.18 of a millimetre in length. And what amazes me is that this is a species called Deuterus minthurus palipes, which is very common on the vegetation in gardens in the south of England. This is only about a millimetre in length, but even though they're so tiny, they still have a relatively sophisticated reproductive behaviour. This is a female on the left and a male on the right. And they have a fairly elaborate courtship. For an animal which is so tiny, it's amazing. You wouldn't think they have enough neurons to enable them to do anything other than feed and sort of walk around. But they do have quite a sophisticated behaviour. Now, this species occurs in two forms, in a purple form and a yellow form. So this is a yellow female and a yellow male. This is a purple female and a yellow male here, again interacting by sort of headbutting each other to get them in the mood, I suppose. But here we have a situation where we have a yellow female and a purple male. Then we have a yellow male approaching from the left here up towards this this couple. The yellow male sort of gets in between these two here and starts nudging away. And then as so often happens in life, the two men are left fighting, and the woman gets bored and walks off in the other direction to presumably go and find another male specimen. Okay, so that's the first sort of tour around the springtails. What I want to do just to finish off with for the last 5 minutes is just show you the sort of work that I'm doing at the moment in trying to map the distribution of the different species. So the main sort of thrust of this work is to produce distribution maps which will be available, and some in fact are already available on the internet, so anybody can access these from anywhere in the world if they wanted to. And at the moment there is a website on the Reading University server where one can look at the maps. There's about 40 species have been done so far. And distribution maps have been criticised, but I think that they do provide a number of very useful things for researchers. One is that they provide a snapshot picture of where species have been found. So it's very quick if you look at a map to see where the species have been found. Does it only occur in Cornwall, or is it widespread through the whole country? Does it only occur on the coast, for example? It gives you useful information on rarity. Obviously, Calembula are relatively under-recorded, but for much better recorded things like butterflies and dragonflies, distribution maps, if there are very few dots on the map, it does give you an indication that the species is rare. It allows you to relate the distribution to other factors like geology and climate. And in the Atlas of Terrestrial and Freshwater Mollusks, there are several species which are very clearly only found on calcareous rocks, for example. But there aren't, at the moment there aren't any obvious examples in Calembula, but who knows. And of course it also stimulates the hunting instinct, which is particularly prevalent among the amateur zoologists or natural historians who one would want to become involved in such a project. If they find that there's no dots in their local area, then it stimulates them to go out and have a look. Now, I've been doing in the museum is going through the Calembula collection and cataloguing at the moment doing the slide collection. And this is the most recent, don't worry about this, trying to interpret this, this is just to show you what it looks like. But on word tables, this is the most recent species I've done, which is called Metaphora affinis. And each slide is given a code, the species is identified, and then the locality in the Ordnance Survey grid reference is recorded, the date, the collector, most of which are by Bagnall in the Calembula collection, then the length and the width, the sex, the condition from 1 to 6, where 1 is, well, 0 is nothing on the slide at all, and 6 is absolutely fantastic, and then a few notes. So this is a very much of a draft, so words like squished will be removed from the eventual, it's not very scientific, but will eventually be removed from the table. But the point about this is that this information is would be very, very easy to put on the internet. So if somebody in Peru found a species of Calembula and they wanted to know whether there are any specimens in the Natural History Museum collection, they could just log onto that species on the internet and download a table which would tell them every specimen that was available, the condition, and whether or not they were holotypes or paratypes. But the only thing stopping one doing this is the manpower involved in producing the tables and the server space to put the stuff on. But it's, I don't know whether this is being done for other species, other groups within the museum, but it would be very possible to put that onto the internet very easily. Distribution information is nearly finished. Distribution information is recorded onto recording cards. Each species is abbreviated as a number, genus, which is the two big letters here, and the species in small case. I think this is the same convention which is used in Recorder, the recording program. And of course, you can include information about grid reference and so on and so. And we have a card index now which has the distribution information from all published records of Columbella in the UK. So these have been extracted from published papers. Okay, now finally, I want to just show you a few maps just to show you some examples. And I'm going to briefly show you six of these. First of all, the overall coverage, in other words, how many 10-kilometre grid squares have Columbella been recorded from? Recorder effort, how many speeches have been recorded from each of these squares? And then I'm just going to show you the latest maps for species, which illustrate some of the features that you can get from this sort of information. So, first of all, I did ask Linda if we could have a computer link up to a projector so I could show you these straight from the internet and the server, but after what happened at the beginning, I'm glad I didn't ask, because you might still be waiting. Okay, so this actually looks quite good, quite promising. This is the 10-kilometre squares of the UK where at least one species of Columbella has been recorded. So the coverage looks quite good. You'd think that this was quite a respectable map. Unfortunately, when you map the number of species found in each of these squares, it becomes a bit less promising. And what this basically shows is where people who've been recording Columbella have been situated for the last 100 years or so. I've lost my laser pointer, so I'll have to use this one. So, for example, Bagnall, who did a lot of collecting around the Edinburgh area, is showing up here. But many of the dots on the map are really only consist of between 1 and 8 species, in some cases single species. So the coverage is really still very, very patchy. For example, down in Cornwall, where one would expect there to be some quite interesting records, there has hardly been any recording at all. And in fact, as far as I can tell, nobody has ever recorded Columbella from the Channel Islands. There's no records at all. So there's lots of potential there for turning up interesting things. Okay, just to show these four species, we've got this is Podura aquatica, which is the species I showed you at the beginning, the one that lives on the surface of water. Now, if you read the literature, it says that this species is very widespread and common, but in fact, there are very, very few records for it. The way I've mapped it is the open circles are records from the literature, and the closed circles are records which are supported by specimens in the collections here, either in Spirit or in the Slide collection, which I've examined and checked. So even a species which is reputedly widespread and common actually has very few records. Whether that's just because people don't bother to record it if they find it, we don't really know. This is near Neumra scorum, which is obviously very common and widespread. So that's an example of where the maps support the conclusions from the literature. Monobella grassii. This one is quite clearly a southern distributed species. Its northern extent is East Anglia and sort of Aberystwyth area. But I suspect it's probably very, very much more common than the map would suggest, because it's, for example, in the Chilterns, it's quite widespread, although I haven't recorded all the points on there. And the final map is this one, which is the very hairy purple springtail, which turned up at the garden centre in Dorset, which is this record here. This, in fact, I found in Devon when we were on holiday last year, and it's, I think, the northernmost record in the world for Lathriopygia longicita. But that clearly is a species which is confined to the southwest of England, although it's possibly introduced. It was thought for a long time to be introduced because these records are gardens, and this one is the garden centre. This one is in a fairly isolated, wooded, natural valley in Devon, and it would seem unlikely that it's been introduced, although of course it is still possible. So I think all these maps give you some idea of the way in which you can use this information for a variety of purposes. Okay, now finally I want to, this is a final overhead, I just want to point out the advantages of using the internet for taxonomic and distribution work. Access to the internet is, of course, free, in inverted commas. Certainly if you work in an academic institution, you can access it for nothing. So any information put on there is available to everybody. unlike published atlases, which you may have to buy, for some of them can be quite expensive, which go out of date almost as soon as they're printed, maps on the internet can be updated as soon as records are received. And this gives a very good incentive for collectors to visit new sites, because they know that if they go out and make the effort to do collecting, if they send it into the person who's coordinating the scheme, and they're fairly prompt, they can get their records put on the site within a very short length of time. So they know that if they find a new locality, then people will become aware of it very quickly. And to give you an example of this, when I was writing the overheads for the talk, a specimen of Willosia buskei ran across the scanner on my computer, which I spotted this thing out the corner of my eye and caught it in a specimen tube and identified it. And it turned out to be Willosia buskei, which is a new record, county record for Berkshire. And if the map for this species is on the internet, it would be possible to make that record within 5 or 10 minutes of the collector actually finding it in that 10-kilometre grid square. So you can see that the internet is an extremely powerful way of recording information. And it would be possible eventually, for example, if the manpower was available, to have a system where you had a map of a species. You could click on a dot, and then you could get all the information about where specimens were held in different museums in the UK, and the specimens' rarity and who collected it and things like that. But that's probably rather a pipe dream, and it would involve quite a large amount of financial support to eventually get to that stage. Okay, I think I'll stop there and say thank you very much for your attention.
Before I open up to anybody else wants to ask questions, that's okay, I'd like to ask you one, which is, you're a senior lecturer in ecotoxicology. Are you using springtails in that work? Are they particularly suited to
Well, that's how I originally got interested in the animals, because we were doing a lot of work around a big smelting works near Avonmouth, and we'd worked on various different animal groups as sort of individual species in the lab. We wanted to start looking at whether the pollution from this big smelting works was affecting the biodiversity in the soils, and we started looking at collecting samples, and most of the things that came out were mites and Calembula, and when I looked around for a key to identify them, there wasn't one. So that sort of stimulated me into trying to find out how one would go about identifying the animals. And what you tend at Avonmouth, what you tend to find is that you get as in many polluted sites, as a pollution increases, the biodiversity goes down, but the abundance of individual taxa can become extremely high. If I can use an analogy, it's rather like in a river where if you have a sewage outfall, the number of species is very greatly reduced, but you get an enormous population density of tubifex worms because they don't have the competition of, for example, the fish coming along and eating them. And I think with Calembula, you get a similar thing where you get one or two species which are normally relatively rare in soil can become hyperabundant because the competition from the more common species is not there. So there is a potential for... I have a PhD student at the moment who, in fact, is looking at this in contaminated soils in Wolverhampton, of all places, and he's trying to relate the level of pollution in the soil with the springtail diversity. But at the moment, we're not absolutely convinced that it will work, but she's in the middle of the project, so... few months' time, I could probably tell you a more sensible answer.
Are there any questions, please? Yeah, that's a really dumb question, but how do you distinguish adult Calembula from immature stages? Is it pretty easy or pretty difficult?
Yeah, you can...
Sorry, Steve, can you just remind you to...
Right, the question is, how do you distinguish adult Calembula from juvenile Calembula?
Yeah.
Well, the obvious, and this is you said it was a silly question, I'm going to give you a silly answer first of all, which is the size. So if you know more or less what the species is, then if it's very small, then it's a baby. But also, the relative size of the head and the body is quite a good feature. But for a taxonomist, the thing to do is to look at the distribution of CT on the body surface. And as the instars progress, the number of CT on the body surface increases.
So in other words, for non-specialists,
After you've looked at them for a while, you can begin to... It's one of those situations where it's a bit like the jizz of a bird, you know, if you're identifying something. After, when you've looked at enough specimens, you begin to recognise what... when a specimen is a juvenile. It's not a terribly convincing answer, I know, but...
Do they have a definite number of instars?
No, some species can go on molting for very many times. For example, Falsomia candida, the species that... The question is, do they have a fixed number of instars? Falsomia candida can have 40 or 50, go through 40 or 50 molts, and in some species they alternate between an instar which is reproductive and an instar which is dormant. So they can produce eggs, and then they molt, and then they live, eat and feed for a while, and then they molt again, and then they reproduce, and then they continue to do that.
So they both count as adults for your key?
Yes. I mean, the morphology doesn't necessarily change. But there are some species which exhibit a phenomenon called ecomorphosis. And this is at certain times of the year, they can change their morphology. For example, the species that swarms, I showed you the pictures of, they can develop spines on the rear end of the body, which have been in the past have been described as new species. There's a genus Isotoma where the ecomorphic form develops big spines on the back end of the body, and these specimens were described as a new genus called Spine Isotoma until somebody kept some specimens for long enough and realised that when they molted they got these big spines on the back of the body. The question is, why do they swarm? There are a number of suggestions which have been put forward. One of them in Calembula, which live in areas where there's snow and ice, it's possible, thought that possibly they do it because it's easier to migrate over the ice when it's frozen than when it's not. So they form together in large groups, and this enables them to migrate. They seem to... Nobody really knows where they come from when they suddenly appear, but it's likely that the conditions for some reason or other are just perfect for them. They all sense together that it's a right time to migrate. There is a lot of evidence for pheromones in Calembula as well, aggregation pheromones, and they seem to just decide to migrate in one particular direction, but the actual function of it people don't really know.
Calembula are sometimes described as being one of the few groups that seems to decline in diversity from higher to lower latitudes. Do you think that's true, or do you think that's just an artifact of the sampling?
I'm not sure that that's true. The papers that I've read, particularly from tropical areas, one of the problems is that if people are only sampling in the soil, then they can underrepresent the numbers. Certainly where people have done canopy fogging, there are huge numbers of Calembula come out of the canopy. I mean, I think there was an example from a forest in Mexico, which was, I think, about 10 square metres was effectively fogged, if you see what I mean, and about a million Calembula fell out the trees. So they're very diverse, particularly in epiphytic plants.
But they may be less diverse in the soil.
It's possible if they're under very heavy predation from ants, presumably. But certainly the species lists from tropical rainforests that I've seen typically have 120 or so species, whereas in the UK you'd expect maybe 20 or 30, maybe 40. So I don't think it's necessarily true that they're less diverse.
You just bring up earlier on about the smallest insect. The smallest insect, as far as I know, that's something that's different, is a thing called Dicotomorpha ecmectarigus from the States, and its male is...
I thought somebody might come up with a smaller one. What is that, a fly, is it?
It's a parasitic Chironoptera.
Right.
It lives in the eggs of sogans. Gregarious parasitoid in the egg of sogans.
Yeah. I mean, you do wonder, don't you, how something that small has enough nerve cells to do anything.
Yes.
Because, I mean, the human liver cell is about the same size, isn't it? Astonishing.
You didn't mention parasites. Are they parasitoids?
Yes. They're... You sometimes find them with huge nematodes So you can get a Calembula which has a nematode which is about a centimetre long, comes out of a Calembulum which is only 2 or 3 millimetres long, curled up inside the body. They have the usual range of protozoan parasites and things, and they also are affected by fungi as well.
Peter?
Steve, lots of questions I'd like to ask, but I'll stick to one. Just one comment back on that question of species ratios. I get the impression that the tropical to temperate ratio, the data I've seen, be involved with somewhere between 1 and 3 to 1 on the tropics area, in Colombia, with the mean somewhere around 2, which would make it low compared with certain polymetabolous groups where it's probably 5, 6, 7, 8 to 1. But a question about that species ratio.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful contrast between this ubiquitous and abundant group and other major groups in the soil and littered layers of the world, such as mites and perhaps small beetles. Do you have an explanation for why there are so few species of Calembula generally speaking in comparison with these other very significant groups? I can think of one obvious immediate explanation to do with sex and mating barriers and the fact that there seem to be few Calembula species which break the Buster-Gerson principle, but there's not too many very closely related species actually cohabiting.
The question is why are Calembula relatively less diverse in terms of number of species than other insect groups? And one possible explanation is that maybe their feeding strategies are more generalist. I mean, many of them feed on fungal hyphae, and it may be that they're not so like many insects their host plants are very specific. And maybe with Calembula, because they can ingest a much wider range of different species of food items, that there isn't the situation doesn't exist for them to evolve in very many different into very many different species. Maybe if they're in the soil, they can eat. I mean, there are experiments which have shown that Calembula do have preference for certain species of fungi, but they will, if you present them with 10 species of fungi, they will actually eat all 10 species. They may show a preference for one of them, but they will still eat all of them. So maybe it's just because they're not so plant host specific as many other insect groups. That's the best explanation I can think of. If you open up the guts of springtails, they tend to be most of them tend to be full of fungal hyphae or fungal spores. So it's maybe their generalist feeding behaviour that means that they're less diverse.
Last question, Roger.
If I remember rightly, Forsoria candida is parthenogenetic, and you're showing one of the symphytic species, males and females. Can you make any sort of rough generalizations about bisexual or unisexual or parthenogenetic populations or species?
Parthenogenesis. The question is about parthenogenesis, which I can't say the word. Seems to turn up in across Calembula in many different groups. Where people have looked at Calembula that live permanently in the soil, there are a lot more species that are parthenogenetic in the soil than there are running around on the surface. To put it simply, there are in many species that live in the soil that nobody has yet found males. So it seems that nobody really is sure why they're parthenogenetic, but most Calembula groups have some representatives in which only females have been found. So it doesn't seem to be confined to one particular taxonomic group of Calembula, but it seems to be spread throughout. But why that is, I don't have no idea.
All right. If anybody's got any more questions, there's going to be some small refreshments out there as usual. People have already gone out to start serving them, and so I'm sure that you can ask Steve any more questions there. In the meantime, I'd like to thank you very much again for telling us about this interesting book.